Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to part one of Life in Technicolor. It's my audio dispatches from Hot Docs, North America's largest international documentary film festival, happening right now until May 5th in my hometown of Toronto, Canada. Part one finds me talking to director Tom Berninger about Mistaken for Strangers, which on paper is the documentary about the indie rock band The National. In reality, there's a whole lot more to it, as Tom joins his brother Matt and his bandmates on the road, and along with directing a documentary about them, learns an awful lot about himself and gets very introspective within the scope of the movie. So rather than this becoming just a DVD extra or the sort of thing that would appeal to fans, Tom has created something that will appeal to movie fans of all walks. Tom was nice enough to take a few minutes and talk about his film with me, so listen in as Tom and I discuss his new film, Mistaken for Strangers. So Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on Hot Docs as well. It's a fantastic film. And
this is a crazy time. I can't wait to come up to Toronto and relax for a little while and have some fun. All the pressure's kind of off, so this is going to be, I think, a really fun festival.
Very cool. At the beginning of the movie, there's a scene where Matt's doing a radio interview, and he's talking about you because the interviewer he frames it as, well, it's two sets of brothers and you. And he says, well, I have a brother. And he says, I'm not really sure if he's into the band. I think he likes other music. So when we come into this film, what was your relationship like with your brother at that time?
Well, I mean, we had Christmases together, and we, you know, Thanksgivings and you know, weddings and funerals, and he would come in and I would come and go to visit him in New York, but we never really lived together, and we certainly never really lived together on a bus and close quarters, and it was, it, you know, like, the situation there was, you know, like, we picked that little piece of interview for the beginning because he did get a lot of interviews where everybody would mention it's a band of brothers, and it seems like lots of times that people just thought I just didn't exist, and I thought that was kind of funny, but my brother thinks I have a chip on my shoulder, but I just wanted to be associated with the band. You know, I thought I was somewhat creative. I don't have any musical talent, but I'm the one brother that's not in the band, and that would, you know, that just wants to be have his name on a music video. Like, oh, that's Matt's brother. He did a music video, or he did video content for their website. That's all I really wanted. I don't have a chip on my shoulder, as my brother would say.
But it's because of the demands of touring and whatnot. It was, you guys, like, you weren't like bosom buddies, but it was the kind of thing where you'd see him only every once in a while.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Christmases mainly.
Yeah.
Over the years, I would go up. He would have me come up to New York for a week or 2 weeks, but as far as living together and certainly working on this thing, no, it was a brand new experience. Right. It was an adventure, definitely.
And also, just same thing from that same interview. What was your take on his music? Like, was The National your kind of thing, or?
Well, no. I really do like the music, and it's pleasant, and it's really good. But I've never really been into the indie rock or just kind of scene. It's good stuff. I go see shows with other friends, and it's a lot of fun. But mainly, I've always been into more of the heavy metal, hard rock, heavy metal genre. I think when I was a teenager, I purposely did that just to rebel maybe against my brother. I don't know. I mean, like, I had no other friends that were really in the metal, so I kind of explored it for myself. I think I did it when I was like 13 or 14 to be ironic because I was into art, and nobody, like, at the time, now Nirvana is great, but at the time I thought Nirvana was really depressing, so I wanted, like, it's like, whatever happened to Iron Maiden? Whatever happened to Judas Priest? This is in the mid-90s.
Right.
And so I kind of just, like, wanted to be different, so I'm listening to this heavy metal that people roll their eyes at. But then I ended up finding just the beauty and the awesomeness of it all. Perfect. And I'm like, this stuff is actually really good. And so it kind of, it just went downhill from there. And I just, in a weird way, I just feel strange walking around with my headphones on, listening to anything but, not aggressive music, but just fun, loud, powerful music, because people like me and a lot of metalheads are not aggressive people. They're just kind of quiet, or they're shy, and this is an outlet, and that's I just feel weird walking around, you know, with my headphones and listening to light pop.
Gotcha.
Like you know, so
yeah. So when you started documenting the band, what was your plan? And if you'll pardon me, did you have one?
No, I was hired because I needed, at the time I was out of a job. I worked at a TV station in Cincinnati, but I had quit that because I was just not happy with it. And my brother, it just happened to be, it's like, well, you know what? I'm going to be going on tour in a month. Why don't you come out and tour with us? And I'll give you a job. You'll be a roadie. And I said, I'm going to bring my camera. And my brother thought that was a good idea because I went to film school, but I hadn't made a movie for 6 years or so. And all I really wanted to do was get my name, like video content for their website or a DVD extra. And because I thought, well, at least their band is kind of getting bigger. Maybe that could be good for my reel, you know? And it's a it's already higher profile. If it's a DVD content, it's high profile for what I was doing at the time. It's sure. So it was simply just to get my foot in the door for maybe being a videographer or something at the time, you know, just getting my feet wet again and making videos.
Right. Did you watch any rock documentaries in preparation for this?
No. I'd seen, you know, Gimme Shelter, and I'd seen, you know, The Last Waltz. I mean, I'd seen them in college. I mean, these are important movies. And I've seen Flight 666. That's the Iron Maiden one. I didn't think I was going to make a documentary. And, I've Errol Morris has always been, you know, like his earlier movies, like Vernon, Florida, and Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, and those were great, you know. But I knew the nuts and bolts, basic nuts and bolts of documentary filmmaking. But I knew that whatever I'd be making wouldn't be there would be better filmmakers out there to make a proper documentary on the National, if there ever will be one.
Gotcha.
I just knew that I did know a little bit that, like, since I'm his brother and I'm going to be filming this, it has to be special in a way that, like, no other filmmaker could probably do it. But I certainly had no direction, you know. And I wanted to make, early on, I kind of wanted to make a goofball monkeys thing. I wanted to lighten the mood because these guys are kind of known as a kind of a brooding, dark band. And, you know, with Mr. November and other, I mean, I think they got great rock anthems, but people just think, like, you know, there are other songs like Sorrow and I don't know. They do have darker songs, but I just wanted to at least say these guys don't take it too seriously. These guys are fun, just playing good music, but these guys are out there having fun. That's and cool. I wanted to try. And so that was my attempt early on, to just lighten the mood, but there was no direction. There was just like little bits and snippets of ridiculous stuff that could never be in a full length movie.
Gotcha.
You see a little bit of that in the movie, but
oh yeah,
not
no,
much.
No, yeah, you do. I was gonna say a few times when you sat somebody down to kind of get your little bits and stuff like that. People seem really game and enthused when you start, and for most of these pieces, you leave really long takes where you can sort of see this what the hell expression wash over them. Like they start answering or they start doing what you're doing, and then it clues in as, what am I doing here? were you noticing that at the time, or is that just something that you noticed when you were watching it later? Like, could you kind of sense that, just that reaction from them?
Yes. I think I think after I don't know who it would have been, what band member would have been, but after the first one, I think the other guys started talking to each other, saying, "Okay, Tom's going to interview you, and these questions are not what we're going to be like. Just be prepared for anything." And I wasn't out to get them, but I honestly was really trying to ask them questions that I found interesting. And I'm not trying to be funny, but I really was like, people seem to be really liking this. What's now called the wallet question, where I ask them about their IDs. You know, if they wear their wallets on stage with them while they play big shows, and that goes beyond to, you know, do movie stars wear their IDs? Because I just feel like I just saw my brother and saw these guys as human beings backstage, but then become something else out in this crowd and under the lights. And I just find it funny because I'd see them from side stage and I'd see like lumps in their back pocket. Like there's their wallet. And it's just weird that like they're out there playing and playing guitar, but they're all condensed down. And when it all comes down to it, they're all condensed down to a little ID with their mugshot, you know, and their name, their address. And it's just ridiculous. I mean, I find it ridiculous that they're playing in front of thousands of people and they have their, you know, they just have this stupid looking ID. You know, I just know that everybody's driver's license is terrible. And it's right. Just, I find that funny that like, you know, I find it funny that, you know, Russell Crowe has one of those, you know, I mean, those are the kind of questions that I tried to ask. And also, but also, you know, I tried to just ask them things that were on my mind, you know, and I certainly tried the normal documentary questions route, but I didn't they're just not good. And then I started asking them about brothers, about their relationship with their brother. And it eventually just transitioned into me complaining about my brother to them. And then and then when I was watching these interviews, that was the most interesting part for all of us in the editing room, because the band members started becoming my psychiatrists or like my shoulder to cry on. And we really started seeing a movie here that was like different. And hopefully you got to know the band members. For all the fans of the National out there, hopefully you got to like, and I'm getting good feedback that you still get to know the guys.
Oh, yeah.
But in a different way that any other, you know, and that was important to me. And like, I thought like maybe, yeah, they're not talking about their influences or their inspirations or how they make, you know, necessarily make a record, but they talk about what it's like and or what it's like to be brothers or what it's like to be around my brother. And I just hope that it was we kind of went through the side door, yeah, you know, yeah. into this documentary. So, yeah. Long answer.
No, it's good. It's good. Now the thing though is when you were going through these interviews and they were, you know, they may not have gone the way you wanted them to. Like you might have sensed, well, that was awkward. Did that have any effect on you going, like, as you went along? Like, did you ever kind of get disheartened or whatnot from these little kind of bad dates?
Yes. I mean, because when I was doing the interviews, I did not have a direction. I didn't have an end goal. I didn't know where the movie was going. You know, there a lot of documentaries. I don't know. I mean, it was an open-ended documentary. I had there was no race where there's going to be a winner or a loser, or there's like a competition documentaries, or there was no finish line to this thing. And so all my interviews are very scattered and very just random, and 90% of them are on, you know, the floor. But I was scared, and a lot of the guys, I mean, Brian, the drummer, who's pretty quiet guy and doesn't like to do interviews, but was really giving of his time. He let me shoot himself, like him in a shower, because yeah. I was trying to make a dream sequence at one time. Like he was in a shower and I was filming him, or like there's a psycho scene and he wakes up from a bad dream. I shot all that, but I just used a shower scene. But when he was at his drum kit and I asked him about the drugs question, it's funny because that was at the time. He's a great guy, but at the time he was a little uncomfortable with that question, and he asked me not to put that in the movie, which is the only question I put in the movie. Right. And I certainly didn't try to, like, I wasn't trying to railroad him, or I wasn't trying to you know, hurt him or being like a, I didn't want to be a douchebag. I would, I was really, this band is such a clean and good band and well-oiled machine, and they didn't have any real problems, you know. And I was just looking for some fun. And I really thought it was strange that there's these guys go to bed on time, they, you know, and wake up on time and go out to dinner and talk to their wives or their girlfriends, or, and it's like, man, like I should have been on this. I should have been with you guys 10 years ago. I just felt, you know, so look, anyways, he had a problem with that question a little bit, but he is totally on board and he loves it now, and he understands the whole, where it fits into the whole grand scheme of things.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because you mentioned within the movie being disappointed that there wasn't a whole lot of crazy stuff going on in a rock tour. But is that kind of, that's rock and roll nowadays, like aside from maybe a handful of bands that are really, really tearing it up. Is it almost surprising to see that's what's become of rock and roll 60 years on?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, well, I don't know. Yeah, because maybe it's just indie rock, because metal, I'm hoping that they do. And not that I want people to get screwed up and drugged. That's not important to me, but it is a business and it is a passion. And I think when you get to the level that the Nashville are, and in the movie, it is, they go to the next level kind of, you know, they really get these big venues towards the end, and you can't screw around with that, you know, and you do this for, you know, the Nashville had been touring for years and years and years and playing in front of 10 people, 100 people, you know, who are now their ultimate core fans that are not so happy with the size they've gotten. It's like, they're still like, I wish they were much, everybody does that, you know, yeah, wish they're still small, but I don't know where I was going. It's just, you know, I forget where I was going.
It's a job. Like it's a job. It's a business. Yeah, a tour is a business.
Yeah, and you know, and there, it totally is. And when you get to that level, it's really important to put on a good show. And they have a lot of people working for them.
Yeah,
they have, you know, and they have a lot of people counting on good shows. And it's important to them, you know, and it's not something to screw around with.
So one thing I am curious about is you screen an early version of the film. What did that version play like?
That played much more like the Monkees thing.
Really?
It was, it was a lot of goofball. I certainly, none of the stuff of being at, you know, at home with my mom, you know, like I had shot that stuff, but it's like, it was much goofier and had no real story. There are scenes where it was just a goofball comedy kind of thing.
Okay.
And I screened. Yeah.
And like, would you say that, not to put you on the spot or anything, but would you say that that didn't work, or that you just didn't quite know how to do that?
It worked for the first 15 minutes, and then it just didn't, there was no story.
Right.
And, but then it quit. Actually, it quit twice. The first time it screened was in a different, it was in like this different area, and we moved it to the stage, and both times I didn't have a connector the first time, this from my Mac to their projector. And then the second time, which you see in the movie, was on stage, was like their instruments are in front of us, and at first it doubled back and went back right in the middle of the movie, went back to the very beginning.
Okay.
And then we had to fast forward it. It was awful. It was so embarrassing. And I kind of checked out. I was so traumatized because there was also no story there. And like, there's some funny stuff, but like, it was a rough cut screening. And it was, I agreed to show it to, for this, you know, and it was already on the books for, you know, for a month, and I had to like get something together, and it was just thrown together. And I was really worried. I was in a deep spiral at the time, but yeah.
Now that was a great answer, but I actually realized I was unclear. As a film, it didn't work, or you didn't know how to do that kind of film. Not the actual projection.
Oh, well, yeah. No, sorry. Yeah,
I was like, good answer on that. Yeah,
I knew what you're talking about. No, it certainly would not have worked as a film.
Okay.
It was just a series of goofball on tour moments with no story. It would have been a DVD extra.
Which it's funny because a lot of old rock movies like The Monkees and like Help, that's exactly what it is. There's no story. It's just them goofing around.
Right.
But it's hard to show those kind of films now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's we always wanted this movie. And like I said, it was a rough cut screening, so we knew we were going to still work on it. But we always wanted this movie to be more than just for fans. I thought the fans would have liked it. I mean, we wanted this to be something more special. We wanted this to be kind of a great story, and it wasn't there. We knew the fans would like it, but we just wanted to get other people to like it. You know, cool. My brother and I have always loved, you know. I mean, we definitely differ in some areas, but together with comedies, we usually always gel.
Right.
I used to watch, John Hughes movies and like Trains, Planes, and Automobiles and Uncle Buck, you know, I'm not comparing myself to John Candy, but like we love those movies. And when we started seeing that some other footage, like my parents' footage, and when I finally had the guts to check out some of the footage where I'm kind of getting really emotional, and because I shot that and I didn't really look at that for like almost a good like 6 months, you know, I can't tell you, but like I just didn't want to look at that.
Yeah,
and that's when we knew like this could be something great, or hopefully great.
Well, that actually leads me to my next question, because the film really earns its stripes when we see the decision for you to put yourself into the film. And that scene is really well done, by the way. But as far as like the actual process, what inspired you to take ownership of it and put yourself into the film?
Well, early on, I shot myself, you know, knowing that like, since I'm the one brother that's not in the band, it might be funny to see me because I'm just physically look different than my brother. You might share a little bit of the same features, but like, I thought like it might be a great idea just to get me on camera, just in case, like a Michael Moore, just like, you know, because I only had one camera, and so I had to change it up. So I shot myself as much as I could either in the mirrors or whatever. But it was towards late in tour, and when I kind of got released or fired, is when I really started putting myself on camera through the behest of Marshall Curry, the executive producer, and Corinne, my brother's wife, who helped me edit the thing. It's like, I don't have a movie here yet. Let's just keep on making it, you know, like the only way this could be something is I document my struggle on making this movie. And it was certainly after tour and through Corinne picking up the camera that, you know, that the movie became much more of me, and when it became, when it started to become much more of me, I started to give me a little like we realized that is the best stuff, and so I let it happen. But then it made me much more nervous because I got a lot of skin in the game now. It is me, and I just like and that's why it took a long time to finish this movie and cut this movie the way we did it. Because this is not about the National anymore. It's about me and my life. It condensed down to 80 minutes. It's gotta at least make us happy with, you know, happy. And we've been blessed with what has happened, you know, here at least in Tribeca. So
yeah. Was any bit of it, a way of taking ownership of the whole project and the whole situation?
Well, yeah, I think it was. I mean, because I didn't have much of a movie with the band guys, and the only way to make a movie is to inject me in it and take owner, yeah, totally take responsibility for possibly a mess of footage that I had 200 hours of footage and really nothing, no glue, nothing to hold it together. So yeah, it was a little bit like, okay, if I'm going to go down with the ship, I am going to go down with the ship, you know, and I'm going to keep filming myself. You keep filming me. I'll say whatever I want. I'll still do personal diaries, and and let's see if my failed movie, if I'm talking honestly about my failed movie and about the struggles at finishing something and completing something, you know, if we get anything in the end of this, you know, and we did, you know, it was.
So how did you inform Matt of like the new direction of what you were working on in terms of like, you know, putting yourself in it and maybe we can do it this way?
It was probably he knew what I was doing towards the end. He knew, and he was totally supportive because he also saw the goofball. I mean, not I'm trying to be a goofball, but I have a way on camera that's like that he found very charming, and he was definitely pushing me to like put let me see every single scene that you're in, Tom, because this is much more interesting than seeing us on stage. You know, and so towards late in the game, maybe six months to a year ago, he started to really see a lot of the movie, and I mean, he was always familiar. He knew of the footage because I was shooting him, but like the actual movie itself being put together, he was behind for a while.
And was he digging it when you guys started putting stuff together?
Some stuff, yes. Some stuff, no. I mean, Corinne, my brother's wife, who, like I said, helped me edit the thing, and she's a co-producer. And also Craig Charlin, let me mention, he's not here, but he's one of the other producers. He's a young guy that my brother had hired, and he was big in the fiction films and narrative films. He came in about a year ago, too, just to help construct and tell the story. But there were moments when we said it's bad until it's good, and I think that goes with anything. It's like it's always going to be bad until it's actually good all of a sudden, you know. And it takes a lot of work, and a lot of just switching things around and moving things this way, and you know, and just in those post-it notes, and like, you know, that post-it note thing was my idea board. There's a separate board over there with the actual like what if we use this here, you know. And there was many late nights, a lot of fights. The fights got worse the better the movie got, you know. because now everybody is like, now we might have something, and so everybody's fighting for their vision.
Now everybody's invested.
Yeah.
Or now they're really invested.
Yeah. But he was. Oh, in the end, we have a great movie. But yeah, there are certain times where there are certain things left out of the movie, like certain shots, because either I didn't want them in or my brother didn't want them in. But I mean, it all ended up okay.
Right.
Hopefully I answered that question.
No, yeah. You did. Absolutely. And I was going to say, having gone through all this, what advice would you give to any artist who kind of finds himself in over their head?
You're not in and over your head. You just have to relax. And certainly if you're not comfortable with it, don't put it out. I know sometimes people are under pressure with other investors, or you need to put it out there. But trust your instincts, number one. Obviously, it's, you know, I'm going to say generic stuff, but it's just keep on working on it until you feel like if it's not, if you don't feel like it's there, it's not there. If you don't feel it, it's not right yet. And like it took 3 years to make this thing, and you get 78 minutes of footage that we hope people are following and enjoying, and I think they are.
Right.
But just persevere and don't give up, and also kind of just, you know, like my brother says in the end of the movie, if you feel kind of like, if you don't feel very good inside, you got to act like you do on the outside.
I was going to say, if it's not working for you, should you just fake it until it comes to you?
Yes. Because you're not faking it, because that's actually you.
Yeah.
That's a great line my brother said on tour. It's like, and it's like a lot of people are like, some people are saying, why is he saying fake it? It's like, he's not saying fake it. He's saying just do whatever you have to do to get where you want to go, you know, if you, you know, and if that means putting a smile on in a crowded room where you just feel so uncomfortable and going up to talk to somebody, then do it, because you're just going to beat yourself up and you're going to hate yourself for the rest of your life if you don't just, you know, as we say, jump in the cold water.
Yeah.
And get it done.
So to bring this back to where we started, now that you're done this project, what's your relationship like with Matt?
Well, this past week's been a lot of fun. We have a great relationship. You know, I'm still currently he has a separate garage that I'm sleeping in. It's a furnished garage. So, I've been editing this movie for the past, you know, 2.5 years. So we were very close. We actually still live in the same, you know, practically house. it's good. We grew up. I mean, in this time on tour and editing the movie, we really started to figure out ourselves as adults. I finally saw him as an adult, whereas he wasn't such of a rock star anymore to me. I saw his faults and his shortcomings and his temper or his whatever, his moods. And I know, like, I saw him much more as a human being, and he also saw me as a 30-year-old dude, not a 9-year-old dude, you know, and he also saw me that I'm not a kid that not that he controls, but like it was fun to watch both of us put in great input on this movie, you know, and it was fun to see him realize that maybe like look at me, like I made a great cut, that was a great edit, you know, and it was also fun to see him like work within my ideas, you know, so we have a working relationship that is interesting and might be fun to explore in the future.
And again, to go back to where we started, what do you think of The National?
Oh, they're a bunch of great guys. And
their
new
and their music.
Their music. Well, I have heard, I don't know if you know, are you a fan of the band?
Sort of.
Yeah. All I can say is that their latest album, which I have heard, this comes out. I'm plugging this thing, but
it is the
band was always known as critical darlings, but like their music has always kind of been what they say growers or slow burners, where you would have to listen to it for a while to appreciate. And I would agree with that, because some of the stuff I just didn't quite get, or I didn't wasn't my thing. But this album, this new album, I don't know. It seems like they're just doing something. It seems really mellow, which is kind of nice. It seems like a really mellow album. There's some rockers on there too, but it just seems just smooth. And as far as indie rock and The National, I have it on my iPod, the new album, but I haven't listened to it for about a week, and I'll pick it up again sometime. But it's who knows, you know. You know, I might slow down and enjoy slower music, but there's so much good metal come out these days and slow, mellow metal,
of course. Well, you said that you were aiming to make this film something more than just a DVD extra or something that went on. And, I really think you nailed it. I've been talking about this to anybody who will listen for about 2 weeks now and saying that the difference between your standard rock documentary and the really good rock documentaries are the really good ones are the ones where you do not have to like the band, the ones that work just as a film. And as a film, this movie succeeds. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And I'm really looking forward to how it gets received.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been a great process, and it's been a lot of fun. A feathery woman, carry a blindfolded man
through the streets, showered and blue blazer. So you might have heard that little hesitation in my voice when Tom asked me, am I a fan of The National? And the fact of the matter is, I like their music. I've been introduced to them by my brother, and it's great stuff. I don't really count myself a fan because I know one album and a few tracks, but that's part of the whole point is that a film like Mistaken to Strangers is not the kind of thing that's made as a love letter to fans of the band. It is a wonderful film that just crosses any kind of borders and any kind of love. So I do urge you to check it out at Hot Docs or as it makes the rounds on the festival circuit and in art house cinemas as time goes on. Hot Docs tickets and times can be found at their website, hotdocs.ca. There's a lot of great stuff playing this year, so I do urge you, if you're anywhere near the Toronto area, to check it out and come see some great outspoken and outstanding films. My coverage will continue, of course. You can find all of my posts and further audio dispatches by going to thematinee.ca, and there's a section at the top that says festivals. You can find within there all of my dispatches from Hot Docs, all the coverage you would want, and then some. As for the podcast, you can find both Hot Docs episodes and full classic episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them by going to Listen, Apple's podcasting app, Stitcher Radio, Blueberry, and the iTunes Store. They all give you ways to subscribe and get alerts when new episodes drop. My thanks again goes out to Tom Berninger for taking the time to sit down with me. And until next time, I'm Ryan McNeil. We'll see you at the matinee and at Hot Docs.